Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday, June 4th. Let's see. Currently, we've got 48 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and no weather update from Cedric Haynes. So I'll tell you what the National Weather Service is telling us. Sunshine in 69 today, clear tonight, 43 is the overnight low. 70 is the expected high tomorrow with very slight chance of an afternoon thunderstorm. Looking for a high of 72 on Friday. 78 under mostly sunny skies on Saturday, hitting the 81 degree mark by Sunday. Heber City currently registering 51 degrees now. Looking for mostly sunny skies and a high of 76 today. We've got clear skies tonight with an overnight low of 40. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, 30% chance of an afternoon shower, a high of 76. 78 on Friday, again, with another slight chance of an afternoon shower. All sunshine in 83 on Saturday, 86 on Sunday. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias previewing this week's City Council meeting, including a public hearing for next year's budget. And finally, the founder of the NIACA organization, Jackson Kaguri, who works with HIV and AIDS orphans and grandmothers in Uganda, talks about his recent to visit Park City's Rotary Clubs. After more than a year of community criticism and questions about transparency and accountability, the Park City School District's new leadership is revamping policies. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Discontent in the district had been brewing for several years as the community felt the former superintendent and Board of Education kept too much behind closed doors. Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman agrees previous leadership made mistakes.
We had made some missteps in terms of violating our own policy and not holding people accountable.
Community complaints amped up in March 2024. That's when former Superintendent Jill Gilday signed an agreement to resolve a federal discrimination investigation that found over 180 incidents of harassment in the district. Parents expressed disappointment with district leadership and Gilday at the time, saying their plans for next steps were too ambiguous. Separately, in November 2024, community members alleged Chief Operating Officer Michael Tanner had exhibited potentially criminal behavior during his time at the district. In response, the district launched an external investigation in December 2024 to look into the allegations, and the Utah Attorney General's office opened its own investigation in January 2025. The investigations focused on Tanner's remote work agreement, military service, and special duty contracts. The district says it's now making policy changes based on the findings. In July 2024, Gilday sent a memo to the school board explaining Tanner had permission to work remotely to accommodate what he claimed was his military reserve duty. But the district investigation found Tanner lied about his service, both to investigators and in a July 2024 KPCW interview. He said he was still working as a reservist at the time, but had retired from the military in November 2021. Even so, investigators said the lie was not criminal, as Tanner had never used military service as a reason to use paid time off. Board President Meredith Reed said the district has always followed federal protocol related to military employees. However, it's now in the process of adding a military work policy to ensure rules are clear. Among other things, the policy says the district will provide military leave on terms equal to leave granted for things like jury duty and bereavement. The district is also working on developing a work-from-home policy.
We work with the public, so it's very difficult to justify working remotely when you're interfacing with the public on a daily basis.
Some in the community have also bristled over Tanner's compensation package, which included a $77,600 special assignment contract for district-level safety and security issues, duties that were already part of the COO's job description. The board has asked Huntsman to review these types of contracts, which are common. While none, including Tanner's, showed any policy violations, Board Vice President Nick Hill said the current rules need tightening. Huntsman said there are a lot of contracts she questions. For example, there are some special contracts where employees are paid their hourly rate. However, special contract work is meant to be paid at the Bachelor Step 1 rate established by the district. Huntsman hopes to have policies regarding working from home, military service, and special duty contracts before the board in June. With Tanner's position eliminated and new and revamped policies on the way, Huntsman said district leadership is looking to the future.
I have strong relationships with our employees and our families, and we intend to continue to grow those relationships and rebuild trust with not only internally within our school district, but with the greater Park City community.
Reed and Hill said the board is also working on relationship building within the board and beyond. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Park City's Historic Preservation Board will take another look at plans to remake a former boarding house at the top of Main Street. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has this preview.
The property at 176 Main Street was built around the beginning of the 20th century and has been known as the Centennial House and the Durkin Boarding House. The home was an important source of housing in Park City's mining era and early skiing days, according to the Park City Museum. On Wednesday, the Historic Preservation Board will consider approving a proposal to deconstruct and rebuild the home using as many historic materials as possible, according to a staff report. The architect leading the project has made revisions to reflect the home's design in the early 1900s, which board members previously requested. The board also asked if the structure could be lifted, but the staff report indicates an engineer has determined that is unfeasible. The designated historic site has been vacant for some time and most recently underwent renovations in the 1970s and 80s. The property was condemned and is considered uninhabitable, according to documents submitted with the application. A report on the physical condition of the home lists issues including black mold, animal carcasses inside the building, and alarming signs of structural distress. On Wednesday, the Historic Preservation Board will hold a public hearing and consider approving the reconstruction plan. The meeting begins at 5 p.m. at City Hall. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. Hope you're well on this bright blue sky day.
I sure am. Thank you. Let's talk first. Any new applications coming through the counter?
Funny you should say that. Probably a couple of them of interest to the local radio audience. The Utah Olympic Park, as of late last week, actually dropped an amendment to their development agreement on the table. Not a lot of excitement in it. It's mostly, you know, cleanup and slight amendments to what's been going on over there the last dozen or so years. It's probably the fourth amendment. There's going to be some tweaks and fine-tuning of various definitions and maybe moving a couple of buildings around and redefining uses. Nothing dramatic, no major developments in the proposal, but we're going to be going through that at a staff level. Opening it up to the public, obviously revealing it at a public hearing and sometime in the future with the Planning Commission. The one that's probably going to attract the most interest, but initially will have, you know, little impact whatsoever, is we did actually receive the Dakota Pacific real estate amendment to their development agreement. So the new administrative amendment, if you remember back in March, in response to a action by the state legislature where the legislature stepped in and wrote what we call SB 26, which governed funding of transportation zones. We have a small-scale transit area in Summit County centered around High Valley Transit. The SB 26 effectively fixed and formalized the zoning density and uses in and around what is actually essentially the Dakota Pacific and the work that they've been doing in partnership with Summit County Council through a whole of last year negotiating that development agreement. The state stepped in and said, you know, these are the rules. What that does to the referendum is more of a legal conversation than a planning question. But as a result of that piece of action by the state legislature, we are required to approve the project through an administrative development agreement, not the legislative action that the council took at the end of last year. So we were required to change our law to allow that process to happen. We didn't actually have a process for that. We created a temporary zoning ordinance a couple of months ago, and in response, the document that came out of the council work has been refined and reworded. There are no substantive changes in it, nothing hugely significant, But the processing now has been rewritten in an administrative format. We received that very late last week, late Friday afternoon. Literally have it on my desk right now. No drama in terms of, you know, any, you know, additional drama than what we've already had before. Unit numbers, massing uses, essentially the same that came out of the council conversations. It's essentially the same document. But because of the language that were being that was being used in a legislative act versus an administrative act, there's a lot of tweaking and changes to grammar and form and format. It's very much a legalese issue. One thing that is a slight difference, the original agreement actually tied some of the approvals and the phasing, what we call tranches of work in terms of tranche one, tranche two, tranche three. They were being tied to very specific actions by Utah Department of Transport and their work at Kimball Junction. No dramatic changes in how that's tied together, but the way it was being measured in the original document, subsequent to that document being signed at the council level, UDOT have begun to reveal more details of what they're planning to do, how they finance it, how they signal a start and stop of certain actions. So Dakota Pacific and the, you know, our transportation planners have been in contact with UDOT trying to work out how we adjust some of those key triggers for what permits get issued when. So that's going to be a minor point of discussion that I imagine we're going to need some clarification on it. The critical action as far as the public might be concerned is that the administrative process does require a hearing and recommendation by the Planning Commission, but that's not a public hearing. It's a meeting, public meeting, a recommendation from the Planning Commission, and then a subsequent public hearing will be held in front of the county manager. So that would be an opportunity for the public to be involved. But obviously prior to that, there will be a public meeting. There will be documentation published. So people will be actually see the information, see the documentation, and identifying issues for themselves. But those are the two big ones that have come in.
So are you saying that it does go back to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission or no?
It does. The Planning Commission are required to make a recommendation to the manager. The manager is the approval authority, so it will go to the Planning Commission, but it will not be a public hearing in front of the Planning Commission. Hmm. It's a meeting they analyze. If you remember, we actually do a very similar process at the canyons. Most of the canyons projects are hearings in front of the Planning Commission for a recommendation and then an approval by the manager.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned that you had put in place a temporary zoning ordinance. You've got how many months left on that, and do you have that process then figured out?
Yes, the ordinance actually, we did it April 9th, April 10th. It was the beginning of April that actually went into play. Temporary ordinances run for 6 months. So 6 months after April, that ordinance would fall. It, depending on what actually happens, typically we would actually be required to put some form of permanent ordinance in place. But I believe that this is the only application that would be impacted by the Senate Bill 26, and therefore currently it's the only applicant that needs this ordinance in place. We're trying to bring our codes into compliance with state law about the process we're required to have. We just don't have this administrative development agreement process right now. It may be sometime in the future we'll need another one for a different reason, but this one was fairly urgent because as soon as the Senate Bill 26 passed, there was an opportunity at that time for Dakota Pacific or anyone else involved in this project could have actually submitted an application, and we wouldn't have had a process. That's why we did the temporary zoning ordinance.
All right. Well, but it sounds like that ordinance has to be approved by the Summit County Council before you can bring this forward to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission.
That was done back in April.
Yeah. Oh,
so the TZO was approved. It's in place. Now the actual application for the administrative DA came in. So now we're just processing that per this ordinance. It's very similar to the legislative development agreement process that we have, but obviously there are some wording, some actions, who does what when, who takes responsibility. Those things just need to be ironed out. It's the bureaucracy of government, I'm afraid.
All right. And so it does sound like this may do away with the phasing agreements that were made.
It might change some of the trigger points. Nothing dramatic. For example, we tied a previous, a release of a certain number of approval for a certain number of building permits would occur when UDOT carried out a particular action. We've been told by UDOT that those actions are not hard and fast measurable rules. So it's when the Kimball Junction project is approved, whether it's financed, what stages they are in the design, when they start construction. Those trigger points are not under our control or Dakota Pacific's control, but they tend to be publicly acknowledged trigger points. We picked what we thought were measurable points. We've since been told by UDOT and our own consultants that they're not strict, hard and fast rules. So we need to come up with a slightly different way of measuring it. And probably it's going to be a calendar of events. Once it's financed, we know that's announcement. Then a certain number of months or years will come into play before the developers, whether it's ourselves with a public-private partnership or whether it's Dakota Pacific, there will be timetables of when certain actions are allowed to occur on site.
Okay, and you mentioned that it's more of a legal issue to determine than a planning issue what happens with the referendum. But what about the filing of becoming a municipality?
That's a whole mystery in my eyes. I scratch my head over that one just as everybody else does. That's still out there. That file still exists. I don't believe any of the parties involved in this project are really interested in that as an option, but it's a right that lies on the table. It's been filed. I think I don't know what the future of the referendum process is going to be, whether there's going to be appeals and lawsuits afterwards. That's kind of separate. The administrative development agreement that we have right now, if that goes through essentially as written, let's just assume that that's the case, then I don't understand why anyone would be interested in following up on the municipality idea. It's a right that they have. I just don't think anyone is interested in that.
Okay, moving on. The Summit County Council recently saw 6 proposals for the Klein-Dolly parcel in response to the county's request for proposals. So what's the process there?
I was hoping that a couple of weeks ago they reviewed those proposals. I believe there was a lot of excitement and interest in what was on the table, a lot of creative ideas. The council did have some subsequent robust discussion. We're going to get back together, and the council will be making a decision. The last time we met, it was going to be as early as today, but that's actually that decision as to what their next action is going to be has been put off till next week. I think we have some, rather full agendas on the housing front and other issues in front of council. So next week, I believe the council will be making an announcement as to what their preferred path is going to be.
Okay. So at this point, have they even been narrowed down, or there's still 6 in play?
I'm going to say there are 6 in play. There are probably clear preferences, which obviously I'm not going to reveal here on the radio. I think the council have their own ability to express their personal opinions. But there are definitely leading contenders in my mind. But if everyone can be as patient as until next week, I think the answer will be revealed next week.
All right. Let's see, the county council at its meeting today will be discussing the moderate income housing strategic plan. Again, this is a state requirement.
This is a recognition. If you remember, again, back in March of this year, the council in recognition of the fact that everyone is talking about a housing crisis, an affordable housing crisis. It's not unique to Summit County. That is putting additional pressure on Summit County, and we know that coming out of the legislature, there's more pressure to come on what counties and municipalities are doing. In fact, the governor actually made an announcement, essentially put together some tools and information, probably with the intent of putting pressure on existing communities about are you doing your fair share? Are you doing what you can? We've had the moderate income housing plan requirement as part of the general plan for a couple of years now. So this is really a follow-on and development of those things. Back in March, council discussed the need for housing, and the council actually did set a target, 1,500 units in the next 10 years of affordable housing. This is really the first draft of how we go about, if we're going to say that, if we're going to put that number on the table, in a similar way to a few years ago when Park City said, let's put a number, 800 units, out there in the ether, and let's see if we can hit that target. The Summit County Council did the same thing. 1,500 units in 10 years, what can we do? And how do we go about doing it? So Jeff Jones and I have been, you know, putting a lot of work into this together with, you know, other staff who have been throwing their opinions and efforts in. And we've been putting together some drafts of strategies. The interesting thing, it runs with the RFP we're doing for Klein-Dolly. It runs with interest we have on other pieces of Summit County land, but also we're reworking the general plans right now. So this housing plan will influence and be influenced by the general plan process, the current formation or the recent formation of the housing authority. So there's a lot of influence in play. So this afternoon, we're going back to the council. We have an hour-long discussion. We're going to basically throw all our notes on the table and have another discussion about, are we going in the right direction? 1,500 units sounds like a lot in one bite, but over 10 years and distributed in some kind of manner, yet to be decided. We have some ideas across the county. It might be an easily absorbed number. The trick is how we go about doing it. How is it paid for? Where does it go? Do we have the infrastructure? It's a complex problem that's been developed over decades. So the solution is not going to be a simple answer. It's going to be long and complex.
So real quick, though, how is moderate income defined?
It's a state definition, moderate income. That's the 80% AMI. The area median income. So if you are spending more than 30% of your income and you are earning less than the 80% AMI on housing, then you are cost burdened in regards to housing. The problem that we have in Summit County, of course, is that our area median income is relatively high, not just compared to the rest of the state, but compared to the nation as a whole. So essentially, the cost of housing in Summit County is very high. Most people on salaries in Summit County are not making, you know, the 80% or definitely not the 100% AMI. You know, you need to be working two well-paid jobs to get close to that. And the AMI across the county varies from east side to west side and from one municipality to another. So what might be a reasonably high income in one area of the county doesn't come close to buying a residential unit in the Park City environment, for example.
No. Okay. Anything else, Peter, you wanted to mention?
Nothing significant. Okay. We have the usual, I was going to say trivial applications. That's trite and inconsiderate. I don't mean it that way. But if anyone has any interest or thought about what we're doing, just please get in touch, give us a call, and we're happy to talk to you.
Okay. Peter Barnes, the Summit County Community Development Director. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie. Bye.
In the studio now with a preview of the Park City Council meeting this week, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks. So the council Thursday will hold a public hearing on next year's budget. Let's talk about some of the changes. We had to add $20,000 to hold a primary. because we know that's going to happen.
That's right. Sort of a several month-long process, at least 4 months of deliberation, and as we come down to the wire, refining estimates, refining final requests and otherwise, and then responding to the council policy discussions where they've queried department heads or asked for a little bit more or a little bit less of, you know, different levels of services or staffing or personnel.
Yeah, and you added $460,000 for additional projected parking revenue from the Bonanza Flat parking program. That seems like a lot.
It may be. We're not sure. We're expecting a tremendous amount of utilization. And other times when we've added parking, sort of the first year you get a bounce, and, you know, we shall see. So this will be a revenue projection. So much like the existing fiscal year, that's something we can refine throughout the year.
Yeah, so basically a wash, though, you're hoping, with the expenditures that you're going to be making up there?
Basically, and it's two seasons we're projecting. As you recall, our fiscal year begins on July 1st, so we're really projecting for this summer and this fall, and then we'll get the future spring, so next year.
All right, and there was a note that about $305,000 was removed because the city couldn't agree on terms for leasing the transit to trail vehicles. I thought that we decided we weren't doing transit to trails and we were just going to use city buses instead.
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer, and maybe the verbiage that we chose, it was confusing. We are extending the purple route, and we are increasing the frequencies of the purple route. In doing so, we need to enhance the equipment or the fleet to provide that elevated level of service. But in addition, we're not sure that purple route needs to be this big 52-foot bus. And so we had contemplated smaller vehicles, and that's where the initial expenditure was from. But given the fact that we had trouble sort of securing the contract, we're going to be repurposing some of our existing, what we call like our Grasshopper ADA equipment that was going to be termed out. So we'll run some equipment longer than we should have otherwise. And then I believe we are purchasing one additional vehicle, but I want to recall that it's under the threshold, that it's something that I can authorize administratively. So a little bit of moving around equipment, but the transit to trails may be a misnomer, but now you'll be able to get to the location riding the purple, and the purple will be on an accelerated frequency.
All right, and you also looked like removed $10 million for the U.S. Park and Ride, U.S. 40 Park and Ride program. Isn't that part of the agreement, though, with Deer Valley?
Well, that was already there. I thank you for asking that. We already had the $10 million allocation. That's already memorialized in the budget. It's been there, I believe, for at least one, if not two fiscal years. This was an additional amount, $5 million from the Transportation Fund and $5 million from the Capital Fund. That was more or less moving money into an area that we know we're trying to build a balance over time. Being in here with you for several years, you've seen community center building, Mark Aquatics. We'll be building balances towards major capital investments over time. It's rare that we can do them in 1 year. And so this money doesn't go away. It's sort of memorialized where it is. It wasn't just reallocated across the page. So that doesn't negate our ability to make some type of an adjustment in the future. Council just asked us not to do that this year.
Okay. Now, has the budget team kind of been looking ahead in terms of what kind of savings or perhaps losses the city will see going forward without hosting Sundance?
Yeah, I don't know. I shouldn't say I don't know. Yes, and we've been working with the chamber on that. The chamber has also enhanced their sort of analytics and financial forecasting enterprise, just like the city, and we work really closely on that. So this year, we're not actually anticipating, obviously, any decrease. And then, you know, we do believe there's a tremendous ability to fill in this week with skiers. And I know that a lot of conversations are happening with the Restaurant Association, with the Lodging Association, the Chamber, the County, the City, where I think people are saying sort of let it rest for a year or two and let's try to quantify or determine the impacts and then identify if we're seeking to infill this with another event or a community organizing event. And so we do believe that the week can be filled in. We believe that there is demand. Not sure how that's going to eke out yet, but it is currently not impacting our financial projections.
All right. Well, certainly filling in the week is not going to be filled in the same as it did with Sundance. And I think that was part of the problem with Sundance is that we saw the hotel room rates just, you know, double.
Yeah. And so To be clear, there are certain aspects of our economy that are going to be disproportionately impacted, or specific businesses in particular. There are certain restaurants, there are property owners on Main Street, there are individual lodging owners or people in the lodging space that are going to be directly impacted. Now, some of that we hope will be regular skier traffic can mollify that. Long term, we're not concerned about that. In the short term, though, there are clearly some lodging properties, some restaurateurs, and some private property owners that are going to be disproportionately impacted. For the municipality, you know, there will be a whole host of costs, however, that we won't incur. We won't be incurring the additional law enforcement, parking, pedestrian management. We provide elevated snow removal services, transit services. So there are also a lot of expenditures that we'll be able to ratchet back to balance things out.
Okay, another item on the agenda is the park and rides. And the question, I think, before council is, which one do we improve? Or do we build a new one there at the Gordo area, or do we spend the money adding utilities and restrooms, bus chargers to Richardson Flat? Is there a staff recommendation on this?
I'm not sure there is, and I don't think we're actually anticipating sort of a black and white answer tonight, a yes or no. I think what we're trying to do is keep moving the ball forward because we have sort of several things occurring at once. We are currently working on a recreate 248 corridor study, so we're working on the 248 corridor. We know that that corridor is going to need to be buttressed with some type of a park and ride, or park and rides, plural. So the report actually contemplates a Gordo-only solution, a Richardson Flat-only solution, or a Gordo and Richardson Flat solution. And what that hybrid would mean is one of the locations is an express-level, reliable service that operates every single day. So think about workforce or day skiers trying to get into town. And maybe then the alternative location is sort of this overflow. We just talked about Sundance and FIS weekend, Olympic-level size events that occur here. We would have this overflow. We could overflow a lot where we could provide supplementary services. But the real questions are going to be in size, scope. Are there other things that we want occurring at this location? As you know, a park and ride is sort of a light industrial use. So much like an airport, it can accommodate amenities, but it can also accommodate bus bays and barns on the back of a facility. So there's a lot of opportunities. The staff report that we wrote really tries to keep the ball moving by addressing additional council questions about who's parking at Richardson Flat over the past 2 years? Where are they from? How long have their commutes been? You know, can the Gordo properties be split or subdivided? Can it accommodate additional uses? What are the travel times from the 248 and 40 corridor to the Richardson Flat location compared to the Gordo location? So really moving the ball forward, my estimation is we'll have a few more conversations about this. But eventually, yeah, we want to start organizing our investment of time and energy and resources to a one-location solution or a two-location solution that buttresses well with the Recreate 248 study as we try to enhance that corridor like we're enhancing the 224 corridor.
Okay, let's speak about 224 and the bus rapid transit lanes. What's the latest here? There was no staff report in the packet.
No, I know. We're still working on that, unfortunately. You know, working closely with High Valley Transit in Summit County, and as you know, we've had, I don't know, I'll say, you know, as this project sort of maybe enters the red zone. That's bad. That's a sports analogy. As we're walking the ball down the field, how to best utilize the existing right-of-way and minimize impacts to the corridor, either around the White Barn or on the way into town, that aligns with our community values but still maintains the efficiency, the accessibility, and the effectiveness of the bus rapid transit program. And so I've worked on projects like this in the past where you're sort of coming down to the wire and you're working with the different teams that obtained the grant or the granting entity 7 or 8 years ago and trying to make sure that the final decisions are the most efficient, most effective, and aligned with our community values. So we're looking at intersections like Jans and Coles, or what sometimes we call the box of rocks, and how we want that really complicated intersection to function and what to prioritize. We're looking at some of the medians that we have on your way into town that were put there for aesthetic purposes and to slow traffic, and maybe the potential to scrap some of those and use the existing right-of-way instead of widening. So sort of narrowing the approach here at the end, working with High Valley Transit in Summit County.
All right. Let's see. It's reported in the packet that the March 2025 sales tax collection, the highest on record, and that all winter sales tax distribution outperformed the prior winter by almost 5%. So last time we talked about this and already reported this, you had said, oh, we're not counting apples to apples. So are we counting apples to apples here?
Yes and no. There's obviously these two different things occurring. And, you know, what's occurring is we get a distribution every month, and there's a lot of noise in that distribution. Some of it is actually collections from the previous month that we're making up on. But it's a fairly good litmus test of where we are financially. March was a very strong month. We're really fortunate to have March come in so strong. That's one of the reasons that we feel a little bit more confident about next year's projections. It was one of the reasons that the mayor and council were more confident about allocating a 2.5% COLA for municipal employees to keep up with the cost of living. A lot of work goes into this number: lodging, restaurants, retail, special events. Very strong month for us, and we were up over the last March.
Okay. The community center, recreation center, you've learned that there's not enough money in the budget, about a $4 million shortfall. So what's the plan?
Well, I think the plan is we are recommending council works with the recreation team and attempts to close the gap. You know, we made this estimate 2 years ago, and if I could go back and do it differently, I would probably make sure I revise this estimate every 12 months and not wait 24 months or more. So we have this $4 million shortfall, and I think there's a bunch of things going on here. I think, you know, one is we didn't have any contingency in the original estimate, and every project that we do needs to have kind of an owner's contingency and a contractor's contingency. We've also really scoped the wet and dry utilities. So we'll need a considerable enhancement in the power to this location, considerable enhancement to the water, to the sewer. And these are in the soils district, so they require trenching that wouldn't normally be required, soils removal that wouldn't normally be required. So we're not asking to delay the project or scrap the project. We've done some value engineering to knock, I think, about $800,000 off of the estimate. But we really are hoping to use the Lower Park RDA to close the funding gap. The previous money in the Lower Park RDA had been solely dedicated towards an overhaul of Lower Park Avenue. And I think over time, as we've changed the paradigm for how we're treating that road as no longer this collector corridor that's bringing in traffic over 224, the level and depth and scope of that project has gone down considerably, which hopefully frees up resources for us to take that and move it into the community center, which we're really excited about. And we don't want to lose a construction season. You know, so obviously we're disappointed that we have this this cost estimating gap, and we probably should have come in 12 months ago and added a few million dollars because materials, supplies, inflation. So perhaps it looks worse than it is. We think we have the right resource to tap, but ultimately this is a policy decision for the mayor and council.
Hard to believe, though, that the architect didn't build in that 3% contingency. Isn't that like standard?
Well, I'm not even sure we can blame the architect for that. I think that might have been our fault, and so I'll take responsibility for that, and we should have revisited this 12 months, not waited 24 months, and I think this number would have been around 1.8 or 2.2 million and not 4 million. So we'll learn from that.
Okay. Let's see. I wanted to ask about water rates. Are those going up for just everybody? Because we saw an increase in the commercial rates last year.
Yeah, I think it depends. We are sort of, I'll say we are overhauling the way we're making technical changes to the way to our billing structure for single family residential customers and irrigation, so both. But under the new single family rate structure, you know, I think most customers are actually going to receive a small reduction. And that's because we're sort of changing our structure based on lot size and away from what was conventionally known as meter size. For the last 50 years in this community, depending on the size of your structure, there was sort of a base rate, and then there was a meter rate, and the meter rate would accommodate your flows. But really what we've gone over the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, as we've implemented sustainability and conservation measures, where a lot of property owners have conformed and complied and have reduced their water, but have seen their water rates continue to rise. So we're changing our model to sort of water budget to say, you know, a 1 acre lot, a half acre lot should use a reasonable amount of water. Here's what it is. And so, you know, modest pricing for that amount. And if you exceed that, there will be some significant conservation penalties. So it's more or less a restructuring. We think most users will see a reduction, but we're talking about over 5,000 accounts. There's also a lot of noise in this data, and I don't want to oversimplify. Some people's water rates will go up. There is an inflationary component, but most or the majority will go down.
Okay. Real quick, what's going on at the former Peace House? I noticed that there's a bunch of chain link fence around it.
Yeah, that's our next, I guess, municipal community or affordable housing project. The municipalities own that property for the last 10 years or so, and we've used it for transit operators and other types of employees. About 2 years ago, due to its condition, it needed to be renovated. Council came in and said, you know, what's the best and highest repurposing for this property? We're making it into a triplex. So it'll become a triplex for municipal employees that's in town, next to City Hall, right on transit, Main Street, and the resorts, where hopefully we can get some families in there of our employees that get to live here, ride transit, and be part of our community.
Okay. And any backlash from the state over the banners, the pride banners on the city light poles?
No, none that I'm aware of. Again, I'll just restate, you know, we think if they had intended to ban banners, they would have, and we felt like we were in compliance, and so far, so good.
Okay, Matt, anything else?
That's it, Leslie. I appreciate it. Thanks
All
so
right.
much.
Thank you. That's Park City City Manager Matt Tyus. Well, Jackson Kaguri is the founder of Nyaka Incorporated, a nonprofit organization he founded in 2001 to tackle systemic inequalities, poverty, and hunger in his village in southwest Uganda. He was in Park City recently to meet with local Rotarians about the work he does. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. Glad you could make it. So tell us a little bit about your organization. What is it that you do, and how do you do it?
Thank you so much again for having me. I visited Park City recently and was honored and excited to share our work with Rotarians in the area. My name is Tracy Jackson Kaguri. I was born and raised in Uganda. And what I do is work with children who mostly were orphaned because of HIV/AIDS and support them in their education, health care, employment, food. But we house these children with women we call grandmothers in homes so they can get the care and love they deserve while helping them succeed in their education and health care and food they get every single day.
Yeah.
Organization is a 501c3 registered here in the United States and working in rural parts of Uganda.
Talk a little bit about the problem of AIDS and HIV in Uganda. Why is it so explosive?
So many years ago in the 1980s, HIV/AIDS started ravaging through our communities in Uganda in a way that we had never seen. It became a pandemic, leaving 2.2 million children. Most of the people who hear about HIV/AIDS think of the problem here in the United States. In our communities, it was a thing that came through, mostly through sexual transmission, but also through medical equipment that were not sterilized, through traditional circumcision of boys and girls, and it became an epidemic, leaving so many working men and women dead and their children left behind without anyone's care for them. Most of those children ended up in grandmothers and grandparents who had already struggled to raise their own children, raising another generation of children with no money to take care of these children. That's why we started with the school. Then through our approaches of looking at clean water through Rotary connections, looking at food, farming systems, looking at health care for children take medication so they can grow, those who are born with HIV/AIDS. We were helped a lot with PEPFAR, a program that was started by President George Bush II, helped by USAID programs, which now are not in existence. And mostly now we are reliant on individuals and service clubs, especially Rotary International and Rotary clubs around the world.
All right, so that's what brought you to Park City?
Yes, ma'am. I came to Park City through a connection with Tim Hickton, who is a Rotarian with Park City Lunch Group. We had been working with another collaboration in Uganda, in rural Uganda, Bwind Hospital, and you have a lot of Park City residents who have built there a dental clinic and a nursing school. So that connection led me to speak to Lunch, Park City lunch meetings, Park City breakfast, sunrise, and we have now committed Rotarians in the area who want to work with us to get the help needed in these rural communities of Uganda. So, and for your listeners' purposes, Nyaka has been doing this work for the last 24 years. We are working with 123,000 children being raised by 23,000 women who we call grandmothers.
Yeah. So it sounds like the Park City Rotary Clubs may be doing some sort of international project with your nonprofit. Tell me about that.
Yes, ma'am. The Park City Rotary Club have created a Venmo where people can send donations. The way Rotary Clubs work around the world, they will gather donations. A district around Utah will match part of the money that is raised, and then we will make a Rotary International request to match that money so we can get $100,000 to the women and children who are so deserving. And for your listeners' purposes also, it's important to know that when you take $1 to rural areas of Uganda, it stretches further. So $100,000 coming from these Rotary Clubs and Rotary International will help us reach close 10,000 women and children, helping some of those women start small businesses so they can sustain their own communities.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, because it's not just money for these orphans. It's actually to make the lives of these grandmothers better.
Yes, ma'am. I have traveled all over the world and for all the listeners, and I find grandmothers extend so much love and care to their grandchildren anywhere in the world, including here in Michigan where I live. What we have done, ladies and gentlemen, and to all listeners, is to empower women to sustain themselves. Instead of giving them fish, we teach them how to fish, as the saying goes. So these women start small businesses, they make baskets, they raise chickens, they raise goats. The women we started with have already graduated and now they are business person people. And when we empower these women, they are able to buy a chair for the first time in their house, buy a plate for the first time, buy a spoon, but also treat their own children, their own communities. So 23,000 women, we call them grandmothers because of respect, but some of them are 35 years old, raising children who are not biologically related to them. So you can think of foster system in the United States. We've created that community model to sustain these communities for the future. Regardless whether somebody cuts any funding or something happens, these women will continue to be able to put food on their table, send their children to school, and when children graduate from school, they become also givers in their own communities, creating a sustainable model, one community at a time, one village at a time, and eventually many countries in Africa will get the same model.
All right. Where can people go to find out more information about the work you do or to, if they're interested, donate?
Park City Rotary Club lunch. Park City Rotary Club website has a link for Venmo. Our organization is Nyaka Global, www.nyaka.org. And any donations that come through our website will still work with Park City so it can be matched with the district connection right there. So thank you. Anybody can make a difference, and whatever you are compelled to give, we will turn it into a gift that keeps giving.
Okay. Jax, anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yes, I would like to thank you personally for letting me speak to your listeners. I would like to thank everybody who is listening. I'm a strong listener of NPR News and NPR anywhere I am. I appreciate you, and please know, when you give, we get more gifts in exchange because of what privileges we've been granted in this world. So So I give back, not because I have so much. I give back because I see the results. And we'll continue to give you these updates. You are welcome to go on YouTube, Nyaka Global, and see the children and women we are talking about, listen to their voices, and see their faces. They are as human, as Park City residents, as loving and deserving as any residents in the world. And this world has become a global village for all of us. So please, and if anybody ever wants to come to Uganda to visit, your listeners are welcome to contact us through you, and we can come and join other Rotarians who will be coming in October to make the assessment and bring back the report and meet the people we are serving.
Okay. Jackson Kaguri, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless you.